Hello, Bird Feed. It's good to be with you again. This is your legal editor, Oren Nimni, and I'm here with
Vanessa Ebi, your social media editor.
And we are happy to present our first guest of our legal podcast bonus episode series for all you law nerds on the Bird Feed. And we are happy to introduce Mr.
Sam Weiss.
Sam Weiss. All right, Sam, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a lawyer at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law in Washington, D.C., and I've spent a little time in the past working on prison rights issues for the ACLU and Southern Poverty Law Center at a small office they have in Jackson, Mississippi.
Awesome. And this week, we're going to be talking about capital punishment and mental illness in prisons. And so we've brought Sam on, one, because he is our friend, and also my boyfriend.
It was good. Get that conflict of interest out of there right away.
This is my first time disclosing this to current affairs staff.
Vanessa initially set up this episode just to flirt with Sam, and then we just had to delay, and they were already dating.
This is the only way I can get Sam to agree to hang out with me. Come on the pod. So we have Sam on because Sam has spent a lot of times in prisons and litigating on behalf of inmates. And so we're very excited to have an expert in our midst.
Well, thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this discussion. I think we could probably do a whole season of series about the myriad issues in prisons, not just sort of mental health and capital punishment, but both of those are really forefront intervention points in the current legal movement to reform prisons and also really important areas just generally. So I'm really happy that you're on here and going to have this discussion with us.
Absolutely.
Before we start, I have some questions for Sam that I may or may not know the answer to. Tell us about the work you do now, like substantively the work you do now and the kind of work that you've done in the past with incarcerated people.
Sure. First of all, I should say that I'm here in my individual capacity and speak only for myself. And
ooh, such a lawyer move.
Indeed, afraid so. I work for a national nonprofit that does civil rights cases around the country and a diversity of issues. So we do some criminal justice cases. We also do voting rights cases. We do education cases. We've intervened as sort of quasi-amicus interveners, I'm not sure the exact term, in the Harvard affirmative action case that's taken place this past week. We're working on a lot of the voting rights cases that are taking place in Georgia that are getting a lot of attention right now. We have worked on a lot of diverse issue areas. Currently, what my current job is a kind of a hodgepodge of things. So I do some voting rights cases. I do some criminal justice cases. I'm able to still do a little bit of prison work currently as well, because that's a real passion of mine. And so I try to carve out some time for that. But before I worked in this current job, I worked in offices where all I did was prison rights cases. So I worked at a small office, the National ACLU, called the National Prison Project, where all they do is prison cases. And what that looks like are these big class actions, usually, where you're representing every person in an individual prison or even every person in an individual state prison system. And they're very time-consuming. They're lengthy. Some of them take years or even decades. But they are, along with school desegregation cases, which are mostly extinct at this point, sort of the canonical institutional reform case, where what you're really trying to do is take a government institution that's broken and through the litigation reform it.
And what drew you to that line of work?
So I always had a bit of a soft spot for underdogs, I think, as a part of it. I think that doesn't make me particularly unique among the current affairs crew. On the one hand, representing people in prison really sort of tugs at my heartstrings. And I think anybody, really across a lot of different political persuasions, the first time you really step into a prison, you see what it's like firsthand. You intellectually know before, of course, but seeing it, sitting down with people who are being affected by it, getting to be their advocate, is a really, really powerful emotional experience. And I've seen it happen over and over by, for example, taking interns in for client interviews and things like that. It's a really powerful emotional experience. At the same time, it also played to sort of my nerdier side of feeling like the sort of cost-benefit analysis number-crunching side, which is that not only is it this really horrific injustice, but it's also really, really dumb. There's no need to be treating people this way. We would be a richer and healthier society if we did not. For example, we allow people in prison to get really sick. because the public prison or the private prison or the private prison medical provider or the contracts with the public prison doesn't want to pay for those medications. And then those people come out of prison and get the rest of us sick. Just from a number-crunching utilitarian perspective, you should spend the money on the medication. And we don't because of things like misaligned incentives. So I think it was a balance of heart and head. But also, and this is kind of hard to fathom now, but I went into law school knowing this is what I wanted to do when I was applying in 2010. And a big part of the draw for it for me was that it seemed like this was really one of the critical civil rights disasters. And virtually nobody was talking about it. And it's really hard to fathom that now because that has changed so much. And we could spend a whole hour talking sort of sociologically about why. I think for whatever the merits or demerits of the book, I think Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, was a huge part of it, selling hundreds of thousands of copies and really making it this sort of center-left conventional wisdom that what we have is really abhorrent criminal justice system, along with, I think, a handful of really successful activists among the conservative movement and within the Republican Party to at least on some aspects of the criminal justice system to urge reform. To the point where now it's almost a truism that there's a bipartisan consensus, again, only on some small aspects of reform, but on some aspects of the criminal justice system. And it's become conventional wisdom among sort of mainstream Democrats that the criminal justice system is really a critical site of injustice in America. But that simply wasn't true 8 years ago. So the idea of getting to sort of go in the trenches and fight in litigation was more appealing, in part because it was hard to imagine there ever being the sort of political movement to reform the systems through the other political branches. And there's a sense in which that's changed because there are bills being passed in state houses every month that purport to reform the criminal justice system. Of course, one thing we can talk about is that despite all this energy and this purported consensus, there hasn't been a ton of movement as far as effective policy change.
It's interesting so I was also applying to law school at the same time and did my first fellowship out of law school suing prisons out in California and then went and did criminal defense work afterwards. And it feels like that was a burgeoning moment in like it was just about to be the cusp of this becoming a sort of mainstream liberal issue. But it's always funny how those choices are a little bit an accident of time along with sort of the other things that you're saying, you know, a real passion for the project and for people's, you know, actual lived experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I don't know if you feel some way about this, but this like tiny, insecure sort of part of myself feels the sort of like hipster ownership where...
You know,
just in the sense of it makes me think if I was launching a career in 2018 instead of 2010, whether I would have searched for some more sort of niche thing to feel like, okay, what's a real site of injustice that people aren't talking about?
Because that one's doing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I feel a little bit judgy. I did a panel for some like 1Ls last week and they went around and kind of said what they were interested in. And all the social justice-y ones are like, yeah, like prison reform and criminal justice. And I was like, you guys are such bandwagon jumpers. We were into this before. It was cool. But then I like to remind myself that actually there are a bunch of people that were into it way before. And, you know, folks that were doing prison reform work in the late 1800s, in the early 1900s. And then obviously you have folks like Angela Davis and Critical Resistance really pushing abolitionism well, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s. And so we are also all bandwagon jumpers.
Yes, the people doing the hardest things, of course, came before. And then also, you want people to jump on the bandwagon. If
yes, movement. Please. It's an open
you
bandwagon.
You want it to be cool.
Plenty of work
open
for everyone.
Yeah, I would like this problem to all of us to be out of a job.
Yes, I'm waiting on the day.
Let's dive into capital punishment. And I think for our listeners maybe who aren't lawyers or who are baby lawyers or who are me and have a vague idea of what the Eighth Amendment is but haven't pulled out the Constitution in a long time, maybe we can start off by kind of explaining what the gist of the Eighth Amendment is. And maybe, Sam, you could give us a little history of capital punishment.
If we're asking Sam questions in your answer, I would also love... So for listeners, the reason that Vanessa brings up the Eighth Amendment is the Eighth Amendment is largely the constitutional provision that capital punishment has been litigated under. It need not have been that the case, but that kind of is the way that it's gone so far. And so I would love to, if you have some tidbits on this, this is something that I don't know, sort of how those two things became really joined. I mean, I think they seem obvious now in our minds, but that need not have been the case.
Yeah, that's actually exactly right. And the link between the Eighth Amendment and fighting capital punishment in America in some ways is really historically contingent. In the early 1960s, this small group of lawyers who worked at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund decided that they were basically going to launch a movement against the death penalty in America through the courts because there were these huge, huge racial disparities in who was being executed. Of course, there's this earlier history that's really just coming to a close then about the informal use of execution in extra legal formats. But even the legal uses of execution are concentrated in the former states of the Confederacy and against African Americans. So they launch this campaign to attack the death penalty. It's extremely successful. So within a few years, there's a period from 1968 to 1976 where there are no executions in America. By 1968, they've basically been able to get enough sand in the gears that enough lower court judges are stopping executions. But what they're targeting is a ruling from the United States Supreme Court to declare the death penalty as a whole unconstitutional. And they're really using the Due Process Clause in the 14th Amendment for that argument. However, in 19...
Oh, and for our listeners, can you explain what you mean by the Due Process Clause?
So the 14th Amendment, which is ratified in the aftermath of the Civil War, places limitations on state power, including that they cannot deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So these activist lawyers are taking sort of their big swing at the whole enchilada here with the Due Process Clause, and they lose in 1971. But then they take their shot again under the Eighth Amendment the following year in a case called Furman, and they win, even though several of the justices seem to be more persuaded by the process-ish arguments, basically that it's very arbitrary who's being executed, that people are rarely executed, and it's not clear that there's any sort of merit system as to who is and who isn't. In an iconic line, one of the justices in the majority says that capital punishment is cruel and unusual for the same reason that being struck by lightning is cruel and unusual. So you have this attachment because of the Eighth Amendment and capital punishment in 1972, which puts a halt to capital punishment in America. And this is around the same time that other industrialized countries are also ending capital punishment around this time. And it's often by democratically insulated institutions, not necessarily courts, but there's popular support for the death penalty basically all over the world. But institutions that are in some ways analogous to the Supreme Court around the world are ending the death penalty as elites are turning against it. But what happens in America is there's this huge backlash, and a majority of states pass new statutes because their statutes have been criticized in certain ways in these five splintered opinions in the 1972 case, Furman. There's this huge backlash, and what also happens is that Richard Nixon gets to appoint a bunch of new justices to the Supreme Court. So by the time these new statutes get back up in 1976, several of those new death penalty statutes get upheld as constitutional. And in the same way that they were struck down under the Eighth Amendment in 1972, they're upheld under the Eighth Amendment in 1976.
Man, wouldn't it suck if we were in an era where someone was appointing new justices and it seemed like precedent would be meaningless? That'd be crazy.
It would be. What also starts during this time is that because some of the statutes are upheld and some are not, so states like North Carolina passed laws that said if you commit certain crimes, the death penalty is mandatory. So that tries to get around the arbitrariness problem another way. And the Supreme Court struck those down and in the process launched this campaign that began then and really is to present to use constitutional litigation to regulate the death penalty, to say this form of death penalty statute is okay, this form is not. This process to determine who should be executed is okay, this one is not. Basically, since then, and in a way that was not true at all before this all started in the early 1960s, which processes within the death penalty are okay and which are not is being disputed in the courts. And the Supreme Court itself is constantly intervening, picking apart which pieces are okay and which pieces are not.
Yeah, that does seem to be sort of bringing us up to the modern time. That does seem to be kind of the way that death penalty litigation goes. It seems like there's a couple of death penalty cases every year that go up to the Supreme Court. They are these process-oriented cases, and they kind of fall into one of two categories, right? And there are particular reasons for these categories, but one set of categories is what is the method of execution going to be, and is that method of execution in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And then the other question is sort of what class of people are going to be allowed to be executed? Is it people who have mental capacity issues? Is it people who have particular medical issues? And so at least on the method of execution litigation, that's been largely the result of an activist push to, once the death penalty started being largely done by lethal injection, to illegalize certain drug cocktails or certain individual drugs in those cocktails, and then also kind of outside of the courts to make those drugs harder to attain so that people would technically be sentenced to death, but there would be no actual ability to execute them with the readily available drugs. But it is interesting that I think it's a general tenet of liberalism and leftism that we'd like abolition of the death penalty, but that the legal movement, for the most part, has been focused on, like you were saying, this kind of regulation. Rather than abolishing it, we're making it fairer, quote unquote.
Yeah, like we've conceded the point that it shouldn't even exist. Like, we've given up that battle.
It's interesting, and something I go back and forth on, because that surely was the attempt of this sort of constitutional regulation of the death penalty. So we can give a few examples. So a year after the Supreme Court brings the death penalty back, it holds that no one can be executed for the rape of an adult woman. One thing that that did was it eased the huge racial disparities. They were still big, but sort of the canonical person who is getting railroaded, who did not commit a murder, who may have not committed a crime at all, was an African-American man in the South being accused of raping a white woman. That's the sort of way that the Supreme Court is nipping around the edges, trying to make the death penalty more fair, but in the views of us, perhaps entrenching it due to the fact of making it more fair.
Right. You know, so you're limiting it, but you're also making the thing that remains slightly more palatable. If it's not racist, if you're not executing children, if you're not executing people by particularly heinous means, then I don't want to say it becomes much harder to challenge the death penalty, because it doesn't. You can still think it has the same level of immorality as it did from the get-go by the mere fact of killing people, but it does, in sort of the legal standard, it seems a lot harder, because it, you know, it's pretty narrowly tailored and only focused on a really specific subset of people who have done very specific crimes. They've tried to remove racial disparity, although they've failed, and the methods of execution are the best available in modern methods.
What's interesting is that this is just really how profoundly this attempted regulation of the death penalty to make it fairer has failed. I think there's no doubt that most of what the Supreme Court has done is really nipping around the edges. So things like people who committed crimes when they were juveniles can no longer be executed. But that was always a really, really tiny minority of people who were being executed anyway. On the one hand, I think I'd be very concerned if you're talking about saving this small, very small percentage of people from being executed, but entrenching the vast majority of them by maintaining what really appears more like a fair system. But what's interesting is that as a policy matter, pretty much everyone agrees that this sort of constitutional regulation has really failed, because it's not fairer and everybody thinks it's a mess. The right-wing justices think it's a mess because the liberals have gone along with this sort of guerrilla war on the death penalty that's trying to muck it up everywhere that we can. But the sort of center-left justices still think it's a mess, in part because it's still hugely arbitrary. It's the racial disparities, especially race of victim, not race of perpetrator, are still huge.
Right.
So these attempted fixes have not worked. And one way that we really see this is that there's this really odd tradition that's continuing to present of the Supreme Court justices who, as we've said, really see a lot of death penalty cases, deciding very late in their career that we should just get rid of the death penalty entirely. So it's not really common for a Supreme Court justice on a major legal question of import to change their mind many years under the bench. But it's happened over and over, and most recently with Justice Breyer, who's a center-left justice who's very comfortable with government power as a general matter, including in the criminal justice sphere. But he's decided in the last few years that he thinks the death penalty is intolerable. And the thing that seems to really strike at him, and this actually came up in the Madison arguments, is these guys are being convicted and then executed 30 years later. And something
right, he really is upset that they're spending so much time on death row, not knowing when they're going to be executed and so far removed from the crime, right?
Yeah, and I think there's a pretty strong moral case that the 65-year-old person you're executing isn't in a meaningful way the 25-year-old person who committed
the crime. Although it could... that could be a good argument for just executing people really efficiently.
Well,
I'm always wary. Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm always wary because there's a couple of arguments, both from conservative justices in the federal courts and then also like Breyer, that one of the problems with the death penalty is that it puts people in the situation where you're sitting on death row, far attenuated temporally from your crime, but also where you kind of have gone through this process of being thinking that you're going to die at various stages over the past 30 years, and that death row is a particularly bad place in a federal prison to be, and that those are the more onerous things. But that does equally lend itself to reducing the amount of appeals that you get so that you're killed efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And the arbitrariness of the death penalty, it manifests itself in other ways too, right? Like in ways that I think are kind of, I don't know if systemic is the right word, but Harvard Law's Fair Punishment Project, I don't know if you guys remember, they had this wonderful report back in 2016, where they ranked the top 5 deadliest DAs. And these DAs were responsible for the death sentence of 1 in 7 individuals who were sentenced to death in like the period that the project reviewed. Like, for instance, there was this DA from Oklahoma whose name is Bob Macy. He's passed away now. But in his 21-year career, he has sent basically 54 people to their death. That's just in Oklahoma. It kind of feels like, I guess, the jurisdiction in which you commit your crime, it's not exactly luck of the draw, but I guess if you're quote unquote lucky enough to have committed your crime in like a more lenient jurisdiction, like maybe California, then the consequences are drastically different than if you were to have done it in Oklahoma County or Harris County, Texas, which was another one that had these really high numbers. And like that to me feels way too much like luck of the draw. I mean, it's
right.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And what's really striking about it is it's not necessarily about whether you're in a lenient county or not. But what's happened is that as death penalty litigation has gotten so expensive, a lot of rural counties just don't want to pay to execute anybody anymore. And so what you have, I mean, you just talked about Oklahoma County and Harris County in Texas. And what's striking about those counties are they're counties with money and with industry, but in deep red states. So you're probably better off being across county lines in a more rural county where they might have to levy some sort of new tax just to raise $500,000 to prosecute somebody for a death sentence as opposed to a normal life sentence, which, as we all know, there's not a ton of process to whatsoever. And so that sort of geographic arbitrariness is really hard to defend. That's another thing that Breyer, as the sort of center-left technocrat, has harped on a lot as well.
There's this other weird thing about geographic arbitrariness that you'd think it would be better to live in sort of a blue state. But at least my experience watching death penalty cases in Massachusetts is Massachusetts has no state death penalty, but there are people sentenced to the federal death penalty. And that to be a death qualified juror in a state where the death penalty doesn't exist means that you really believe in the death penalty. Like, you're doing it in opposition of all your family members who are kind of liberal and don't like the death penalty. And you're like really excited about it.
Yeah. To explain that a tiny bit more, there's people who do not believe in the death penalty categorically are not allowed to serve on juries.
Exactly. That's what I mean by death qualified juror for listeners.
Right. In death penalty cases. And so in a state like Massachusetts, where they had the trial for Tsarnaev, who did the Boston Marathon bombing, you have this really small minority of people who actually believe in the death penalty, as opposed to maybe Texas or Oklahoma or Arizona. And those people actually are different. They're not a perfectly representative sample of that state. They tend to be whiter, they tend to be more male, they tend to be older. And so in a more liberal state, where it's sort of a more extreme conservative position to be pro the death penalty, you can end up drawing a really bad jury, not just for the death penalty, but for your guilt as well, because you don't want an old male white jury on the guilt phase of your trial either.
You guys have mentioned Breyer's a few times now, and I remember there was a case, I don't know if it was 2016 or 2017, it was called McGehee versus Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And it was 2017 because it was the first death penalty that Gorsuch was able to opine on after joining the Supreme Court. So the 5 conservatives denied the stay of execution for this Arkansas inmate. Kennedy, of course, joined the conservatives. But the 4 liberals were very disturbed by what was happening. one of the reasons why this came up to them is that Arkansas was asking to execute 8 inmates. But the only reason why it was doing that was because the lethal injection was expiring. So they were just speeding everything up. And again, it's like, okay, well, I guess you happen to be on death row in Arkansas in 2017 at a time where the lethal injection is expiring in 3 to 4 days. So you get to die now.
So you better die now. It is super arbitrary. Like, from a PR angle, from the Supreme Court's perspective, it's weird that they continue to kind of allow this, because it does seem like death penalty cases largely hinge more on whether justices are willing to think that people will think this is just too much of an atrocity to allow. And I kind of think that's why they don't allow the execution of children for the most part, or they don't allow it now at all, but that's for the most part why I think that. But the PR, I think, really plays in. Like, I very distinctly remember a lot of the death penalty cases that went up to the court when I was in law school and early practicing as a lawyer. And like Troy Davis's case, I don't know if you all remember, like, had a very big impact on me as it was my 1L or 2L year, but like that was sort of like shocking, and I was like, oh fuck, the law's awful. And they really resonate, because so few people are executed in this country, even though we have, you know, many more people executed than most nations in the world.
Yeah, I think Troy Davis's case was my first real close exposure around being around so many people who cared, which was very different from where I grew up, because I grew up in like an evangelical household. And my parents don't talk about the death penalty very much, but I think they're on board.
Yeah, I think it's the situation where the court has gotten itself involved in all these different aspects of the death penalty, from sentencing to the method of execution, where now it's really hard to get out, especially when another thing that the Supreme Court has done is on these general criminal procedure doctrines, like saying that the Sixth Amendment says you have to have an effective lawyer. What they've done is they've created this huge double standard where for almost everybody, they say it doesn't matter how bad your lawyer is. He can be asleep, he can be drunk, whatever.
Yes.
you don't get a Sixth Amendment claim for that. However, if you were sentenced to death, your lawyer actually needed to have been pretty good, or we're going to void the death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So creating this sort of double track, what it's done is it's implicated itself in really all aspects of a trial where the defendant has been sentenced to death. And it means that before anybody is sentenced, is actually executed in America, they throw their last-minute appeals, and it goes up to the Supreme Court, and they have to deal with it. So I think from a PR perspective, I think probably from a workload perspective, a lot of the justices would probably like to get out of the business of regulating capital punishment. One problem is the two tracks are, number one, you just let whatever the states want to do happen, which is the conservative tack, or the liberal tack is abolish it altogether.
So let's talk about some litigation strategies that organizations have been taking around the country as they approach capital cases. Can either of you maybe expand?
I think this is actually exemplified in two of the early death penalty cases that are up in the court this term. One is a death penalty case about whether or not someone who remembered the crime that they did on account of having a particular form of dementia can be executed. And the other one is a case about whether or not someone can be executed by lethal injection, in particular, if that injection would cause them such excruciating pain because of a particular medical condition they have. And so this sort of are those two categories that I was talking about of who can be executed and how can they be executed. But as far as who's doing the litigation, death penalty litigation at the Supreme Court is now, like a lot of Supreme Court litigation, or like most Supreme Court litigation, is a particularly specialized industry. There are lawyers who are specific appellate lawyers who focus on death penalty cases. Brian Stevenson's organization has been sort of in the forefront of this. Stephen Bright, a professor at Yale, has also done a number of these cases. You kind of see the repeat players do some of these particular arguments. I think the generalized theory is that folks like Bright and folks like Stevenson have hopefully some sort of path that they're laying out ahead that they're going to get towards abolishing the death penalty through this kind of litigation. But, you know, like we were talking about before, it seemed like they're just sort of slicing off the edges, and the core still remains. I don't know if that's a good segue for us, but
yeah, and I think so. Some state legislatures are taking actions directly and abolishing the death penalty, as we recently saw Washington State do. There are progressive DAs now who are running on the platform that they will take the death penalty off the table. So, for instance, there's There's a state attorney in Florida, Aramis Ayala, who has made that commitment. There's also Dan Setterberg in King County, Washington State, which is your people, Oren. He's interesting. He had an op-ed in the Seattle Times in January of this year, and then just a few months later, aka a few days ago, the Washington State Legislature repealed the death penalty. In his op-ed, he outlined the reasons that he gave. And I don't know what I was expecting. In retrospect, it makes sense that he would take this approach. I guess I expected that he would make all my favorite moral arguments against it. And instead, it was very utilitarian. You know, it was very much like all based on budgetary reasons. Like, it's expensive to litigate cases over decades. And it's like hard for the families of victims to think that every time the inmate appeals, they might actually get out, as opposed to just getting a lifelong sentence, you know, and sort of being done with it. And then he was also saying how inefficient it is. You pour in all these resources, you might still lose, or your inmate is incarcerated for so long that they die of natural reasons in prison. So I wasn't super satisfied by the op-ed, but obviously it was effective. And this person, Setterberg, had been a DA for a very long time in King County. So his word obviously had a lot of strength. And I guess at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter why it happens, right? Like, I don't need it to be for the precise reasons that I would list, I guess, as long as it happens.
Yeah. I mean, no more deaths is always great. I think the Washington State Supreme Court decision sort of declaring the death penalty unconstitutional there does highlight two things for me, though. One is, in this era of particularly bad federal courts, state courts might be a good place to get things done. So that was nice. The other thing that it sort of highlights, though, and that we don't have to get into too much, but I'm always torn on some of the death penalty litigation. Because on one hand, I'm extremely opposed to the death penalty, and I'm really happy whenever it's abolished. And, you know, yay, Washington. I'm wearing plaid while recording this episode. So on the other hand, though, there is this weird thing about treating death as different, where obviously the death penalty, I think, is heinous and immoral. However, I don't really know that it's more heinous or immoral than, for example, being sentenced to die in prison, i.e. being sentenced to life without parole, or being sentenced to life with parole where your parole chances are very low, or when you will be paroled, you know, you get out in your late 80s and have had, like Sam was saying, sort of poor medical care that means that your quality of life is going to be particularly low when you get out, you know, combined with all the limitations on opportunities that people who are recently released have. The kind of separation, both in the public mind, but also in the legal sphere, of death cases as substantively different than long-term confinement or confinement in conditions like solitary confinement, which now retired Justice Kennedy sort of bemoaned. I sort of wonder what we're doing in some of those cases, because it's not satisfying either in a logical sense, nor is it satisfying in a moral sense.
Also, thank you for correcting me. The Washington legislature did not repeal it. It was the...
I wish they had, but actually Washington legislator put in the death penalty after it was initially banned, and it has actually been declared unconstitutional, or there have been declared constitutional problems with it, I think, three or four times before this most recent case, declaring it sort of patently unconstitutional. But yeah, people in Washington like to kill people. Sorry, Washington. Yeah,
I think it's exactly right about this really strict dividing line in both the law and in advocacy for death versus everything else. And I think one really exciting thing about abolishing the death penalty would be that so much energy and so many resources go into fighting the death penalty that would be really helpful to have in other injustices in the criminal justice system. And one really striking, I think, strategic error along that line was, in a lot of states over the last several decades, there's been this very strange dynamic, which is that liberals have pushed to create a statute that allows for a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. It's a sentence that didn't exist, actually, until the last few decades. Life normally meant 25 years before the possibility of parole, or something in that neighborhood. Cutting off at the time of sentencing any possibility of parole is really a modern invention. And there was a dynamic where, in death penalty states, liberals were pushing for the possibility of those sentences, and conservatives were opposing them, both of them operating under the assumption that the idea that you could sentence to somebody to never get out, no matter what, would cause jurors to abandon the death penalty. And there's a law professor at the University of Virginia named Brandon Garrett, who's just done this big study about what has caused this big decline in both death sentences and executions in the United States, because there has been a marked decline over the last 20 years. And what he found was that passing these life without the possibility of parole statutes did nothing. A variety of things did seem to help, most importantly, effective defense lawyers who have really sort of perfected this way of getting obviously guilty people to get a life sentence, to be found guilty but not sentenced to death. But that the life without the possibility of parole statutes really didn't help. Because, for example, this dynamic happened in Texas, where a lot of people were being convicted of murder. It has caused thousands of people to be sentenced to this sentence, which means that they will die in prison. And it seems like the liberal advocates for that position, in their sort of unceasing fight against the death penalty, which of course I'm very sympathetic to, ended up making things a lot worse and not better.
You mean a liberal compromise that didn't end up working out? Get out of town. Didn't even get the thing they were going for. So we mentioned a couple of death penalty cases that are going up to the Supreme Court, and one of those was recently argued by the famous Bryan Stevenson of Just Mercy and Equal Justice Initiative fame. And so that case is Madison versus Alabama, and I think it provides a pretty good window into some of the things that we're talking about as far as the death penalty, but also a good segue into talking about the effects of prison and what it's like to be in prison for a long time or on death row, and kind of the impacts of mental health as well. So I don't know, Vanessa, if you want to set us off on that case and tell us what it's about, tell our lovely listeners, who are, I'm sure, not depressed at all by this discussion.
But, oh, it's only getting worse from here.
Yeah, get ready. Make yourself a cup of tea and then come back.
Yeah, so this is a case where no one is disputing the facts. In April of 1985, Vernon Madison was engaged in a domestic dispute with his ex-girlfriend, and the ex-girlfriend's 11-year-old was also in the vicinity, and he was moving out of the household, and a police officer was on site, I think presumably to protect the ex-girlfriend and the daughter. And so the police officer was intervening in the dispute. Madison pretended to leave the premises, but then he actually went to retrieve his firearm. He came back, he shot the police officer to death. And then as his girlfriend was running away, he also shot her to death. And the child witnessed both murders.
Not great.
Not great. We are very much against domestic violence here at Current Affairs. We are also mostly prison abolitionists. It's tough. So Madison is tried by the state of Alabama 3 times, actually, in state court. And actually, each time he is sentenced to capital punishment. Also, just a note for our listeners, some crimes automatically get leveled up the moment that the victim is a police officer or judge. So that's sort of what
Pete, do not insert our level up.
I was just thinking that this is not the right time, Pete. So Madison basically spends the next 20 plus years in prison fighting his sentence in various ways. He files a couple of federal habeas corpus petitions. He files a petition claiming that he was incompetent to be executed because he had suffered both short-term and long-term memory loss. He is later evaluated by 2 experts who sort of come to different conclusions about his mental state. Like, it's clear that he had had a stroke, but in some ways it appears that he was able to talk about the history of his case and the legal proceedings that it took for him to get to where he was in detail, and yet claimed to not he seemed to understand the consequences of his crime, but he didn't recall the crime itself. But then there are other ways in which he has difficulty functioning on a day-to-day basis. So, for instance, remembering where to urinate in his very small cell, like that's something that he appears to forget routinely. And so whether he remembers his crime or not is ambiguous. It could sort of go either way. But there are brain scans that show that his brain and the part of his brain that should have that pertains to memory was damaged by the stroke. So the case makes its way to the 11th Circuit, which concludes that a man with no memory of what he did wrong and who believes he's never killed anyone cannot be put to death. That gets appealed and it comes before the Supreme Court precisely for that question. So the court is looking at 2 questions, but I feel like they're very similar. So the first question is whether the state can execute a prisoner who has vascular dementia and cognitive impairment that leaves him without memory of having committed the crime. So can the state execute this prisoner if this condition prevents him from having a rational understanding of the circumstances that led to the execution? And then the second question is, if we have the scientific and medical advancement, like the brain scans, for instance, that do confirm that there is like severe cognitive dysfunction and degenerative medical condition that prevents him from remembering the crime, is it a violation of the Eighth Amendment to execute this person? And so Brian Stevenson and the state of Alabama argued this case before the Supreme Court on October 20th, 2018. I listened to the argument. I have mixed feelings. I didn't feel like it went that great for Brian Stevenson, who is our guy. But what did you guys think?
No, I agree. This case was a little bit weird. I thought the thing that Brian Stevenson was trying to get at was to create a categorical rule that if you don't remember the crime for which you're sentenced for, that you shouldn't be put to death. This is part of the thing that we were talking about with death penalty, trying to carve out particular areas of folks that should not be executed. In logical terms, I don't think it makes very much sense in that the justifications for punishment in the criminal legal system in the United States largely center around retribution and rehabilitation. One of the arguments, sort of the undergirding principled arguments of why you shouldn't execute someone who has no memory of their crime, is that it would be hard to justify that if they didn't remember the thing that they did. And so, you know, what are they being punished for? They don't know. And what are they being rehabilitated for? Now, I think that makes sense until you remember that the person is dead after you execute them. Yeah. And so there is no rehabilitation, and it doesn't really matter. it doesn't matter if someone really knows what they're being punished for, because they were killed by the state. But if we want to... go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think that Brian Stevenson, I think the tough part for him was that he was saying, actually, it's not just that you don't remember that you committed the crime, right? It's that plus something else. So in this instance, he's saying that plus proof of dementia. He had an example that he returned to a couple of times where he was like, well, if your inmate is in a coma, then you'd have doesn't remember
plus
the crime plus is in a coma. Because I think we wouldn't want, I'm using the we, obviously not us, but I suppose people who are very pro capital punishment wouldn't want, or even people who are, I guess, a little less against capital punishment than we are, we wouldn't want someone to just be able to say, oh, I don't remember, or I blacked out, or...
Right. No, the thing I was saying was just sort of my hobby horse about the case. But Brian Stevenson's argument was this, you sort of need lack of memory plus... I thought the argument didn't go well for him, partially because he ended up narrowing the category really, really severely of folks that couldn't be executed, basically trying to do the good thing for his client, which is like, you know, whatever else you think about who else shouldn't be executed, my guy definitely shouldn't be, because he clearly, you know, you could make a rule specifically for this. But my understanding of Brian Stevenson's general strategy that is that he, I would have rather he pushed for a more expansive class of, I think you can probably get a ruling. I think he will likely win despite not doing that well at oral argument. I think you could probably get a ruling that, yeah, that anyone that doesn't remember their crime, and that if we have some procedure to test whether that lack of memory is genuine, that could have been a, and then, you know, those people shouldn't be executed. And then, you know, we'd have lower courts sort out whether someone, you know, what the standards are for proving someone's lack of memory is genuine. But he didn't do that. He argued on a more narrow basis, basically that someone with vascular dementia and someone who doesn't remember, those people at least should not be executed, and spent a lot of time talking about the facts of his case, which on one hand I appreciated, because one good thing about law, when there are good things, is that it's sometimes a good vehicle for storytelling. And he was able to communicate, I think, some of the hardships of his client's life in prison and why executing him would be so immoral. At the same time, the Supreme Court is less in the business of evaluating facts and more in the business of creating legal standards, and I would rather less people get executed. So I was hoping we'd push for a more expansive standard. So I agree. I didn't think it went great for him, but I think he'll probably still win, just because it seems like this is a particularly heinous case and you wouldn't want to execute the, which I think, like I was saying, is kind of the PR standard for death penalty cases.
I think a plausible interpretation of what happened is that Stevenson pushed for the broader standard when he thought Justice Kennedy was going to be on the court. Justice Kennedy, of course, retired in July. He did not hear this case. Justice Kavanaugh didn't either, because oral argument took place just before he joined the court. So This was before an 8-justice court. Although Justice Kennedy's record was mixed on death penalty stuff, but these sort of Eighth Amendment proportionality challenges to trying to get a specific subpopulation carved out of the death penalty, Justice Kennedy has often been the fifth vote and author of these cases. And I think it's plausible that Stevenson goes for this bigger win when he thinks Kennedy is going to be there. When he's not, now Stevenson has lost below and there's only 8 justices, so he needs to win at least 5-3 to save the guy's life, which means he needs probably either Chief Justice Roberts or maybe Justice Gorsuch. And I think what he tried to do at oral argument is make a much narrower argument, conceding lack of memory was not enough, but that if you have a lack of memory that could plausibly reach this standard of really not understanding the punishment that was going to be given, that the lower court judge, this trial court judge in Alabama, didn't conceive of things that way, did not take into account the dementia. And so that's an extremely fact-bound sort of analysis, because really there, you're not even advancing so much of a legal extension. What you're really just saying is this one trial court judge in Alabama didn't conceive of the Eighth Amendment right in the way that he should have, in a way that would really not have a lot of effect beyond his own client's situation. But that was my sense of things. In part, there was this moment where an agitated Justice Alito said, after Stevenson conceded this sort of broader argument, Justice Alito, sort of in, who is the most pro-law enforcement justice on the court, said sort of in a frustrated way, I thought that's what we were doing here. So I thought that broader question is why we granted cert on this case, because the Supreme Court is not in the business of determining these more fact-bound inquiries. So it made me think that it really honed in on this very, very narrow question that won't make a lot of law either way.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's funny. I shared Justice Alito's frustration because I wanted that question to be addressed. Another justice sharing that frustration might have indicated that they actually wanted to answer that question in a positive way. Because it was Justice Alito, you know, he seems to have it out for criminal defendants, to put it mildly, and not have particular sympathy for death penalty defendants. I think you're right that it sort of cut against that. For further reading on Justice Alito's disdain of people that are convicted of and sentenced to death, you should read the Current Affairs article about Robert Pruitt, who Justice Kennedy denied a stay in his execution on the last day, and then he was put to death.
So the condition of Vernon Madison is tragic, but it's not atypical of many inmates in prisons. Sam, and I think you also, Oren, have had the opportunity to represent, right, some of these inmates, as we were saying. And so a question I have for you, Sam, is we know we have this huge population of incarcerated people who do have mental illnesses and other ailments that come with being incarcerated for a long time and aging in prison. How much professional help is actually available to people? Is the state required to make psychiatrists and medication available to them, or...
So it's really difficult to generalize is the first answer to that question, unfortunately. So it's really true that every state prison system is really different, and even each individual prison is really different. I mean, these are really closed environments. They're not subject to a lot of oversight or public scrutiny. There are some facilities that on a trait like mental health treatment might be doing okay with decent people who are doing their best, and others that are just absolutely abhorrent. You wouldn't believe it. So it's hard to generalize. But as far as the standards, there are constitutional standards that a basic level of medical care and mental health care have to be provided. So that includes things like medication. In practice, that can really vary. And it's not shocking for especially some of these prisons, some of the states that really, really underinvest in their prison systems, to have something like a psychiatrist who comes 2 or 3 days a week for a facility with 1,000 people or with 1,200 people. And this is a population that is disproportionately seriously mentally ill. And so we're not just talking about things like depression or ADHD, which is not to make light of those at all, but also things like paranoid schizophrenia, things that make daily functioning in prison very difficult and that are in fact exacerbated by the prison environment. So in a lot of these facilities, what you have are medication management, because it's a lot easier to kind of knock people out than it is to give people the sort of treatment that they really need. So that's a really serious problem, especially when you're in these facilities that can be really dangerous and unstable, that they have this feeling like they really want to get people under control and that that's the most important thing, even if that's not the best long-term investment in their mental health. And yet another problem that prisons have with people who are seriously mentally ill is this real shift over the last 25 years towards the use of long-term solitary confinement, which is a problem in a few different respects. The first is that seriously mentally ill people very often are the people who end up in solitary. And that's because it's not just the most hardened criminals who have committed the most serious crimes who end up in solitary. A lot of times it's the people who can't function day to day in prison life. And prison guards are like you and I, people who are making trouble at their jobs, people who are annoying, people who are difficult to deal with. They want removed out of their life in the context of prison. They can actually just be thrown into a small cage where they're kept all day. The problem is that the seriously mentally ill who are so likely to end up in solitary are then have their symptoms further exacerbated by being in solitary. And then there's the fact that even people who weren't seriously mentally ill before going into solitary often become so afterwards.
We've talked about litigation trends in the capital punishment area. Are you seeing trends in the kind of strategies that organizations like the one you work at or the one you've worked at before are taking to kind of make sure that people have access to better help with mental illness, but also other physical conditions and ailments that would otherwise interfere with their lives?
Yeah, I think medical care and mental health care are really two of the core issues in people who are advocating for prisoner rights right now. They have been for a long time, but I think that as American prisons are still very violent places by the standards of other industrialized countries, but they're not as violent as they were, say, in the 1970s. And in fact, things like this aggressive use of solitary confinement was a reaction to these really sort of overcrowded, chaotic, hectic prison systems, and this shift sort of a more technocratic management system. So yes, people are thinking hard about medical care in prisons, especially as the prison population is aging. The crime rate has really fallen over the last 25 years. Young people in particular are committing less crimes than young people have in a really long time. We have this combination of two things, which is that Gen Xers were part of this big crime wave, and young people today are not at all, along with this new advent of the lengthening of criminal sentences. Prisons used to be full of young people, and now they're full of old people. And that presents a lot of different medical challenges, as well as things like disability challenges that didn't exist before. So that's certainly something that people are thinking hard about. The same is true with mental health care. Certainly, as far as litigation, the same is true of solitary confinement. You know, 15 years ago, most people wouldn't know what solitary confinement is. Now it's something that gets a lot of coverage. It gets a lot of attention. As Oren noted earlier, Justice Kennedy, before retiring, wrote a concurrence saying that the Supreme Court should think really hard about ending long-term solitary confinement. And there are some conservative lower court judges and perhaps even one of the other conservative justices on the Supreme Court who may agree with that. As far as litigation, probably solitary confinement is the one that people are thinking the hardest about. Although it's important to note that the solitary confinement issue really links up with everything else that's wrong with American prisons. It's really a culmination in those other problems, because especially the mental health bit, because on both ends, it is both the hole where you throw the people who are seriously mentally ill and who are not being effectively treated, and it's this producer of even more sick people.
Yeah, we're not doing a good job. No, I mean, that's sort of been my limited experience, much more limited than Sam, both that millennials are ruining everything, including crime, and that prisons are places that both are ill-suited to engage with folks with mental health issues and also create more of them. It is interesting, though, that, you know, prisons right now are the major provider of mental health services just because of the amount of people who are inside who have mental health difficulties, and yet there is a dearth of resources. If folks want to kind of figure out what the landscape of prisons are, the prison reform suits that people should look at are suits around solitary confinement, suits around prisons that have particularly high suicide rates. There's usually a lot of litigation around their use of solitary confinement or their lack of provision of mental health treatment, and then any suits around lack of provision of medical care, whether that's numbers of doctors or particular focus on diseases. There was a suit here in Massachusetts, I think last year, on state prisons' refusal to provide hepatitis C treatment. That's sort of the landscape of prison reform. So, I mean, that and something that has some crossover, at least in solitary confinement, is sort of the way that prisons treat people of particular protected classes, both racially, but then also a burgeoning issue as far as litigation, although not a burgeoning issue as far as abuse, has been the way that prisons treat trans folks in particular, who are usually more susceptible to discipline and more susceptible to solitary confinement, either as a form of discipline or as a form of quote-unquote protective segregation.
The hepatitis C suits are really interesting. As the listeners may or may not know, I certainly did not know until recently, but about 5 years ago, we collectively as a society essentially cured hepatitis C. Which,
I did not know that.
Yeah, so we developed these extremely effective new drugs that are effective for 90%, 95%, 98%, and that are not particularly onerous to take. So this is like a huge, huge public health success. Hepatitis C kills more people in the United States than HIV does, which is something that we don't know very much about, often in large part because it's really vulnerable populations who tend to get hepatitis C and who tend to die of it. In some ways, American prisons tragically create this really huge opportunity because people who are in prison are vastly, vastly more likely to have hepatitis C than the general population. And it would be this huge public health success to cure everybody who has hepatitis C. And even though the medications are expensive, the American Medical Association says, treat everybody. They're expensive, but it's worth it because they don't get sicker and they don't transmit it to anybody else. And so what we have are American prisons that are hotbeds of hepatitis C because people come in sick, they make other people sick. Those people all go home and take it back to their communities. Many people from more transient communities that might be hard for a public health agency to track down, but prisons, we know exactly where they are. We can give them the treatment that they need. And yet prison systems are not doing so, in part because they're so expensive. So what a few states have done is tried innovative partnerships like prisons partnering with their public health departments or applying for grants to get the hepatitis C medication. But in a lot of states around the country, what you have are medical care provided not by the state, but by a private company that's contracted with the state for a fixed fee. And so, and this is the case even in states that nominally have public prisons. So they're not, you know, the boogeyman of the private prisons, which are abhorrent, but are a small percentage of American prisons. These are public prisons, but they're outsourcing the most important aspects of their operation. And the private medical providers, unlike, say, the state's public health department, have absolutely no incentive to pay for these medications, especially for people who are going to be out in 12 months or 18 months or 24 months. Sure, guys are going to get sicker. Guys might develop liver cancer. They might develop cirrhosis, but not in the next 18 months. So why am I going to spring $70,000 for the care? So this is the sort of area where what we're doing is not only so cruel, but it's so dumb. And I do have some hope litigation will be helpful here. And we have seen class actions, including the one in Massachusetts, pop up all around the country. There was a case in Florida where the judge issued an injunction declaring the old hepatitis C medication treatment plan unconstitutional and ordered a new one. The last time I checked, the terms of that injunction were sealed. And so we don't know exactly how many people are getting treated. But there are plenty of states where the American Medical Association says, unless you know they're going to die in the next 12 months, give them the treatment. It's worth it. Which is, you know, something in the neighborhood of 99.9% prisoners. And there are states that are giving them to like single digits who might have 5,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 people with hepatitis C, and they're giving it to 4 or 6 or 8 people. Mm-hmm. And so that's the sort of just cruel, dumb policy that it's plausible that lower courts around the country could intervene in.
Cruel and dumb, the American prison system.
This might be the most positive part of our entire podcast, what Sam just said about the future of Hep C litigation. So this seems like a great place to seg into our last segment.
Yeah, now that we're on an upswing,
I get to keep up
really,
the momentum.
Really happy.
And now I will introduce our new segment, Better Call Oren and Vanessa. Channeling my inner Pete. In Better Call Oren and Vanessa, we, Oren and Vanessa, take a question from our listeners And the question is usually related to the law or lawyering, and we will have ourselves or our very special guest try to answer it as best as we or they can. This week's question comes to us from @Sartak_M Sharma on Twitter. Oren, take it away.
All right. Our question is, what advice would you give to undergrad students thinking about law school who do not want to work at a large firm, who want to do public service or social justice work? Is law school worth it? Are there better channels to do the same work? Oh, this is a great question. I'm also excited that we have this particular panel because I think that I'm correct in saying that none of us actually have worked for firms and yet somehow are not destitute and not lawyers anymore. So it can be done.
All right, Sam, tell us what to do.
The real answer, I think, is I don't know. I think that there are the cynical among us, and perhaps they're right, who feel like taking these people who are really pushing for reform in these different areas and channeling them into law school and then into these public interest legal organizations that then push for reform in this very specific kind of way, that maybe if those structures didn't exist and you had to be more creative in your activism and you worked through other political means, maybe that would be more effective. Maybe that's right. I'm not sure how to address that counterfactual. Certainly, there are plenty of gloomy days where things aren't going the way that we wished they were, and it feels like that might be right. I think at the very least, my concrete advice would be, if you feel torn about it at all, to don't rush into going back to school. There are a lot of other things that you can do, and finding out how your experience works out is certainly worth doing. Law school will be there at the back end of it. I took a couple of years in between college and law school and was not dead set on going to law school at all. I'm glad I did, and I think that the particular kind of work that I do matches my skill set in a perfectly reasonable way, and if I could go back and change things, I wouldn't. But of course, there are people who feel differently, and so that's not universal advice.
Vanessa, do you want to share some pearls of wisdom?
At the risk of, I feel like I've given versions of this advice before, so I won't elaborate too much. I think it's worth talking to lawyers who are doing the kind of work that you think you might be interested in, and also talking to organizers or investigators or people who are otherwise doing the kind of social justice work that you are interested in outside the law, just to get a good sense of what their day-to-day looks like, what their frustrations are about the job, and like the parts that they find most satisfying. I think like if you're that torn about it, what it comes down to is, on a day-to-day basis, would this work fulfill you? And I think the only way to find out is to sort of talk to these people. That's strange advice, I realize, because sometimes that's actually a luxury. And many of us don't have the luxury of being around lots of people doing the kinds of jobs that we want to do. So finding these people is probably the toughest part. But I have found in my limited experience, I was one of the people who didn't have many people to sort of look up to who were doing exactly what I wanted to do. And once I figured out who they were and asked them for their time, people were always very eager to make time for me and to share their experiences. So I think you will find that there should be people who will be willing to make the time to speak to you one-on-one and give you the information you need to make an informed decision.
I'll just echo a little bit what you all were saying. There are real interventions that can be made in the law. The law is currently one of the major scaffolding pieces of power in the United States. And until that's not the case, knock on wood, in the beautiful future, then there are real interventions to be made on behalf of public interest or social justice in the law. So I don't think it's a worthless place to go for someone that wants to do something of a lefty career. But I think it's worth investigating seriously. It's a career and an amount of debt that one should not take on lightly, and not just sort of to do a thing just because it seems like the ACLU is doing sexy work or something. There are a bunch of other careers, including science and journalism and social work and the medical field and sort of all these other things where radical interventions are sorely needed as well, that might better suit your skill set or might also have a much lower price tag. And I think that's not something to balk at just because law seems good for some reason. I think it's extremely difficult to justify working for a firm. I think it's possible, but is very hard to justify having the amount of power that having a legal degree gives you and then using it to make yourselves and other people money. And so if I were you and I were thinking about law school, I would sort of investigate whether it's something you really want to do. And then if you figure out that it is something you really want to do, I would put an extreme amount of energy into figuring out how you can make that feasible for yourself while doing a career that fulfills you and is good for the world. And then also use your law school training to build up the skill set that you will need to do that career. You know, if you want to do something in prisons in the criminal legal system, be a public defender, do prison reform work, do all those sorts of things in law school so you can see all the different elements of work that you can do in that field and then build up that skill set and also really get a deep understanding of it. We're always happy to welcome more lefty lawyers and then you can be on this podcast.
That's the big prize.
Yeah.
You get to be on the podcast. If anyone figures out what an under slash is, let me know. That's what I said when I described this person's name.
I think it's an underscore.
It's underscore. I apologize to everyone. I apologize for being alive. thank you, apologies, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Samuel Weiss, for coming on the pod.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
Oh, we should definitely hang out again.
Yeah, you guys seem to be hitting it off. I don't know. I'm feeling something here. No, thanks for coming on, Sam. The final question that I have is, which lawyers committee is better, the national one in D.C. or the one in Boston?
I think we might have to cut off the recording.
Yeah, no. No, thanks for coming on, Sam. And thanks, Vanessa, for putting everything together. This was a really nice discussion.
Goodbye to the bird feed.
Goodbye, bird feed. Thanks for joining us on this special legal bonus podcast episode about the death penalty and mental health in prisons. Please look forward to our coming episodes on gender in the law and the weaponization of the First Amendment and
/ neoliberalization of the law.
We might even learn what the word neoliberal means. Who knows? But we have many more exciting guests to come, and me, Maura Nimni, and Vanessa A.B. will be here to shepherd you all through those dire straits.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.